Well, if you look at the course description sheet on page one, or on the opening cover of your syllabus, the text by Grunlin is a pretty good text. It fills in some of the gaps, things we won't have time to talk about. There's also, with the syllabus, with the revised syllabus, an addendum, which was not with the first one, and some reading is assigned in that. You'll see to it as you come. You'll see those assignments incorporated in the syllabus as you come to it. You don't have to bring Grunlin to class. Look at this course. Your grade will be based on examinations. I'll have two examinations over part one and over part two. Part one is boring. Part two isn't. Just want to tell you that. But it's a project. Now, I had tentatively scheduled the project to begin May 1st. It's a week-long project. It's 15% of your grade. You may have heard about the project. Baby egg. Well, I'll explain that to you later. I want to wait till we get further. I don't want to get the project early on because it fits in with the second part of the course, not the first part. Now, so there will be no term paper for this course. I probably should, but I won't. This course is designed for a lot of discussion. There was room for it. There will be more discussion, very likely, the last half or in the first half. Which one of you fellas moved that chair? That was distracting. I think it's the ghost of Christmas past. Was it put there on purpose to distract me? No. Thank you. You're a gentleman and a scholar. Now let me say a few words before we get into this. Oh, by the way, look on page one of your syllabus. Here's your reading assignments. See those? Those are not in the original syllabus, so you're picking up on that. Okay. right. So you know exactly when everything is due. Okay, now the addenda will be due as assigned, but that's incorporated in the syllabus. We'll come to that. Any questions on that? Okay, a few words by way of introduction before we get into the syllabus. And that is this, that this is not a course in psychology. It comes closer to being sociology than psychology. Some of the more clinical aspects of family life are covered in some of Professor Bundy's courses. Does he have a course very close to that deals with family in a direct way in his communication series? Yes, he does. I know he has one. I don't know if he teaches it every year. Have you all had that?
Marriage communications.
Have you had that? Okay. Being offered every year now, I wasn't sure. It's in my department. I wasn't quite sure about it. And there'll be some overlap. Now, I don't know what he teaches, but his approach is not my approach. This is not a psychology course, to repeat myself. I do, nor does it try to be. It's very strange that I should be teaching this. And this I think says something about the subject. I have academic preparation in several fields, and I teach in several fields. I hold seminars. For instance, I hold several seminars. Once in a while, my wife's able to go with me. On family life, I hold seminars on the Holy Spirit, on cults, on evolution, on other subjects. This is the only area in which I hold seminars that I have absolutely no academic preparation. that is on the practical part of it. I have no degree in psychology or counseling, anything like that. But it's interesting that I am called upon to hold more seminars on family life than I do any other subject. Because this is a burning issue. People are dreadfully concerned about family life. Now, When I hold these weekend seminars, I say very little about the material that's in part one. That's the historical, anthropological, theological survey. I do get into theology a little bit, but the historical study of family, of course I have preparation in that, but I don't talk about that. I deal with the practical aspect. But you'll see why it's necessary for us to wade through the historical data and through the theological considerations to really do good work when it comes to the practical part. So my approach is twofold. The foundation is the biblical concepts and precepts and principles of family life. And that's the foundation of my approach. Build on that, I try to build on that what I call practical common sense. You see, it's one thing to understand the biblical principles in the abstract. It's something else to know how, on a day-by-day basis, to make it work. And many people, I have found, understand the principles but have the foggiest notion how to make them work. What do I say to my kids? What words do I use? How do I get along with my wife? How do I build a marriage? Understand, when it comes right down to when you get up in the morning and you face the moment, what do you do? Well, so that's my approach. Now, I'll just say this for the benefit, I'm going to say this, not because it needs to be said to this class, but because it's going on tape and shall be distributed, theoretically at least, beyond the realm of this campus, is that I do have a family. I always have to say that because often when I get out in the seminars in the churches and I begin to say some of these things, people raise an eyebrow as if to say, they're too kind to say it, but what they want to ask is, you really don't have kids, do you? You don't really do that at your house. Those things don't really work. And the answer is yes. This is the second time I've taught this course with one of my own children in the class. So if you have any questions about particulars, you can ask Leslie, because she is the resident secondary expert on this, and I plan to spend the whole quarter embarrassing her, as I am now doing. And I don't mind that. In fact, that's fine. She minds it. I don't. By that I mean I don't mind. I don't mind teaching the course with her in here, because we're all adults, and I think it will perhaps give a tone of reality to this. And Leslie, I think, will be willing to give her viewpoint. Well, often we see things from the parents' viewpoint. We think we know what happened. We look at it through our own eyes, and maybe we don't. Mark, could you give us a little more air? Do you have the... Okay. Are you all a little bit warm in here?
Oh,
yeah, why don't you see if you can... I think we're going to be in here 2 hours. We need some air. Okay, thank you, Mark. I won't say anything important while you're gone. And much of what I... When we get to the practical side of it, I promise you that I will not suggest anything that I haven't tried. A lot of things we've tried at our house didn't work. And I'm not going to tell you about those things. But I want you to know that this approach, that when we get to the family, to the second section, part two, the what we might call the practical application, I want you to know that these things work. But this is not simply at theory, but really work. Now, the next thing I want to say before we get into the syllabus is this, that this subject can get very personal in all kinds of ways. If you're married, you're going to listen to it with different ears than if you're single. However, I think the ideal time to take this course is before you get married. You see, one of the things I say when I get out into churches and hold these seminars is that I am into prevention. I am not into cure. If you want cure, go to a therapist, go to somebody who is an expert, who's trained in it. I am not that person. Now, having said that, let me point out that in family life, there aren't very many cures. The only way to solve a problem is to prevent it, in most cases. That is, by the time real trouble comes in family life, it's normally too late to do much about it. I can't tell you the heartbreaking number of times that people will come to me and say, "Where were you 20 years ago? Why didn't I hear this then?" Now, it can get personal in that we're going to talk about some personal things, although we're not going to go into a lot of detail on things like sex. We're going to talk about it some. We'll deal with it at a certain level. This is not that kind of course. We will say, I think, what needs to be said about it. But it can get personal in this way. And let me warn you about this. Now, I'll take the liberty of reminding you later on that nobody was raised in a perfect family. And what you're going to end up doing as we begin to go through this material, especially the second part, you're going to start examining your own family life, that is your own upbringing. And that can be good and that can be bad. And I want to make this very clear, and I'm trying to head off some comments as they come up. I want you to feel free to raise issues, to make statements about your own upbringing, if it is useful to do it. But one of the things I am determined that will not happen in this course is we're not going to sit as a court of judgment upon your parents. For the simple reason that that is a waste of time. We look back for the single good reason of getting a point of reference for looking forward. But I do not buy this stuff, this modern sentimental nonsense of blaming everything on the past. Because even if you had a rotten upbringing, and most of you didn't, maybe none of you did, but even if you had the worst of upbringings, I absolutely do not tolerate this stuff of using that as an excuse to be a jerk the rest of your life. That is, whatever problems you've had in your upbringing, from now on, you are responsible. You understand? From now on, you have nobody to blame but yourself. And often, when people your age get retrospective, it is not healthy. Let me reword that. It can easily become unhealthy. Understand? We will look back. We can talk about some of these things if we do it with the view of taking responsibility for our own lives, for our own families, and moving forward with the help of God. We're not going to do it with the view of, we're not going to bash our parents, and we're not going to feel sorry for ourselves. Those two things. I'll draw the line on that. Understand that? And if you feel sorry for yourself because you're upbringing, then you just go ahead and feel sorry. I do not feel sorry for you. For the simple reason that it's useless. I know people who have made a career out of feeling sorry for themselves and failing in life giving very good reasons all the way through why it's somebody else's fault. The next thing I would say is this class requires a great deal of honesty. And it requires a great deal of liberty and generosity, because when it gets to family life, much of what we're going to talk about is open to opinion, is a matter of opinion and open to debate and discussion. And we must remember that there are many ways, in most cases, to apply some of the principles we're going to be learning. Every family has its own chemistry. No two families are alike. Now, I want you to know that I know that, because often When we teach family life, we get into personal illustrations, we get into personal anecdotes, because that's just the nature of the subject. But I want you to know going in that I understand that the way that our family has applied or tried to apply these principles is not the only way they can be applied. You know, Tolstoy, in his book War and Peace, said, I don't recall the passage, says that every happy family is, all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. You got that? There's an infinite number of ways to be unhappy, only one way to be happy, and he's absolutely wrong about that. There are just about as many ways to have a happy family as there are to have an unhappy family. You got that? That families can be happy, and let's say family A can be very much unlike family B and be just as happy as family B. Within limits, because the chemistry is different. Okay, so with those guidelines, and I'll remind you of them if it's necessary, we'll move on. A footnote, please do not be reluctant to speak up. We're not going to get into pity sessions and parent bashing, that's all I'm saying, for the reasons I've given. And that, you know that going in. How many of you have children? Four of us. How many of you are married? And about eight married people in here. We got one couple, right? Just one couple. Good. Now we can really work on them.
No couple bashing.
No couple bashing, right?
Sorry.
Right. Well, as I've already indicated, the course is divided into section one and section two. Section two follows section one, which always seemed like a very handy arrangement. The biblical, anthropological, cultural, and historical approach, part one. The practical application, part two. I'm reading now, the everyday practice of family life, if it is to be both successful and biblical, must be based on a knowledge and appreciation of the fundamental character and purpose of the family. That is, before we talk about how to make it work, we must understand what it is supposed to be. Because I teach this course, I get brochures, flyers through the mail regularly. Advertising books on the family. And I have several books in my library from the secular viewpoint. I don't buy any more. I quit buying them because they all say pretty much the same thing. But this is a brochure advertising a book called Diversity in American Families by Harper and Row. I don't have the book. I've got the brochure. It's got the chapter headings. And this introduces us to the modern concept of the family, and we're going to be talking about that as it stands in opposition to the biblical concept of the family. Here's some of the... It's interesting, one of the chapters, chapter 11, is called the non-traditional family forms. I like that word, non-traditional. You know, tradition's bad, non-tradition is good. It talks about single life, which is a very strange family arrangement. Does one person make a family? Well, they might, but not in this course. Understand, I did not deal with the single life in this course. There's nothing wrong with the single life, all other things being equal. I'm not speaking for or against it. This course does not deal with the single. If you're going to be single all your life, this course isn't going to mean much to you. Heterosexual cohabitation. That means people of the opposite sex living together. Homosexual cohabitation, we know what that means. And then commuter marriages, those are the main. But the front of this book, it has family, myth and reality. Here's the myth. And the myth is taken from Webster's 9th New College Dictionary. This is the dictionary definition of a family. Family, noun, colon, A group of individuals living under one roof and usually under one head. Now, that head can be a man or a woman. But a group of individuals living under one roof, usually under one, that's pretty general. Here's reality, according to this book that they are offering. Reality, family, noun, colon. A constantly changing institution that may or may not be formed through marriage, depending on gender, social class, and racial and ethnic backgrounds, it usually consists of a group of individuals living in a household that is not necessarily run by one person. First thing I noticed about that would just as easily describe a litter of pigs out in the barn as it would, just as accurately, as a family as we think about it. I mean, under that definition, two people meeting in a phone booth could be called a family. Or in the restroom, as they often meet, some of these groups. I don't take the second definition of a family. That's what we're up against. Now, we look at the first consideration, marriage. I'm reading now, human contractual arrangement or antecedent entity. I thought I'd throw in some college words to get us going right. How many of you understand that sentence, that question? Good. I always find it's good to confuse the students at least once early in the course to keep them off balance. Otherwise, they organize and attack. Now, here's what I mean. Is marriage simply a human contractual arrangement? That is, it's a human expediency, a deal that adults make, or does it, by antecedent, I mean, does it have a pre-existing reality or principle? That is it from heaven or is it simply of earth? Well, that's the fundamental question today. Is marriage just a deal that my wife and I made between each other? And when she doesn't like the deal anymore, she can get out of it. And if I don't like it, I'll get out of it. You understand? Just an arrangement. Kind of like a carpool that lasts a long time. Or is it something transcendental, eternal, or divine? If marriage is simply a human arrangement, merely a civil contract. Now, is marriage a civil contract? Yes, it is. Is it merely a civil contract? If that's what it is, then it is subject only to the constraints of human expediency. That is, like a carpool, you agree to ride together as long as you both find it expedient and desirable. As soon as things change, you drop out. Well, the modern view of marriage, the secular view of marriage, is just that. It's a mere human arrangement, and this began to be said in the 60s. This is my generation. Since it is that, why do you need the contract? One of the most famous songs that came out of the 60s was Glenn Campbell's Easy on My Mind. You know, that nice banjo beat to it, and you're all familiar with the song, Easy on My, still being played, in which he says to his woman, I like you, you let me leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch, you don't make any claims on me. You don't try to hold me by forgotten bonds and ink stains that have dried upon some line. That is, you let me sleep with you, but you never made me marry you. I can remember it began to be said in the 60s. It's not said, you don't hear it so much anymore. What's a marriage license? What's a marriage a contract? A marriage license is just a piece of paper. If you love each other, you don't need a piece of paper. to, just to please people. And if you don't love each other, a piece of paper is not going to hold you together. Just a piece of paper. Well, a fellow told me that one time. He said, marriage is not just a piece of paper. I said, yeah, and so is the mortgage on your house. Just a piece of paper. Why didn't you just agree to go by the bank and shake the banker's hand and say, you know, you let me live in this house and I'm going to send you $350 a month for the next 30 years. And in the 30 years, you let me have the house. We don't need to sign a piece of paper. Why? Well, it's just a piece of paper. Well, what my point is, pieces of paper can be very important. What's a driver's license? Just a piece of paper. And well, now, I simply have to note here, without discussing, the expanding tragedy of divorce. I don't want to see a show of hands. It may come up in the courts, but I'm not going to seek the information. And I haven't thought about it ahead of time, but I got an idea. Some of you probably come from broken homes where there's been a divorce. Divorce is the expanding tragedy. Divorce is a tragedy. Those who suffer most under divorce are the children. Well, there are children, even older children. If you're 25 years old and your parents get a divorce, it about kills you. It doesn't make a difference. You don't have to be 5 years old. Divorce creates all kinds of legal complexities. Your kid, you know, it becomes your kids and my kids, and this weekend they're our kids, and it gets very complicated. Some kids have three or four sets of grandparents, and as fathers and stepfathers and mothers and stepmothers, and it gets very bad, very confusing. Kids don't like it. And divorce, but even apart from the children, divorce is a real tragedy. Today, if we take the traditional view of marriage, which I take in this course, and I'm sure we all agree to, when we view marriage as an antecedent entity, that is, as a covenant. That's the key word, the covenant. We're going to come to that. We're talking about a divine institution. Is marriage just a civil contract, or is it a covenant? If it's a covenant, if we take that position and begin to follow that position all the way home, logically, we will find ourselves standing in direct opposition to the modern cultural value of selfism. Let me teach you something. You all were raised on selfism. I'm not condemning you. You more than me, because I'm older than you. You understand? I am not condemning you. I'm trying to explain something that may help you understand your own mind. I know what you were raised on, because your generation is the generation of my children. There was you all, most of you could be my children by your age. Not all of you. Thank God. But you could be my children. So I know what you were taught, because I know what my children were taught. And my children were raised on the philosophy of selfism, that the highest, and it's still around, Whitney Houston's song, The Greatest Love of All, very popular song. What is the greatest love of all? It's the love of yourself. And your first duty, you were taught, by taught I mean in music, in many high school courses, in all kinds of subtle persuasions, that your first duty is to yourself. For instance, just to pick an example out of the thin air, this was one of the primary arguments used to try to tell young ladies that they can get an abortion if they need it. Why? Well, you have a right to your own life. You mustn't, and nobody has a right to tell you that this baby must get in your way. The highest love, the duty to yourself, selfism. Now, it's not simply egoism or egotism. Those are different things. But pure selfism means that I am the center of my own universe. My first duty is to myself. The highest knowledge is knowledge of self. And corollary, am I making sense to you? Were you not taught this?
Yes, you were.
This has been this has been drilled into you, and it becomes a part of us. And as a corollary to that, the highest, the first right, civil or human right, that this generation believes it has is the right to personal happiness. In the modern Western culture, especially in America, the right to personal happiness outvotes every other right. Again, in the case of abortion, we are told very clearly that the right of the mother and the father, who's often left out of this picture, the right of the parents to be happy outvotes the right of the unborn to live. And even another person dies to preserve my right to be happy. You've got a right to be happy. You ever told that? Well, now, and this comes into the church. Every preacher has this experience. You'll get couples who are having trouble in their marriage, and they'll go and they'll want counseling. And very often, what they don't really want counseling to make their present marriage work. Sometimes they do, but often, especially if the man has anything to do with it, they don't come to counseling until it's too late. And what they really want is for the preacher to tell them that it's all right to go ahead and get a divorce. What they want, and they'll shop around until they find a preacher who will say to them, now you know that God wants you happy. God doesn't want you to be unhappy. God wants you happy. And if this isn't working, then you have all, it becomes almost a sacred duty to call off this marriage and go find somebody else. Why? Because you only go through life once, and God wants you happy. That's the religious version of it. Well, is that true? Does God want us happy? Oh, yes. Do we have a right to be happy? Well, we have a constitutional right to pursue happiness. But hear me, the right to personal happiness is not the right that outvotes all other rights. And in this case, the right to be happy does not outvote the covenant. This is basic to the biblical teaching on marriage as an antecedent entity. Now, I'm not saying that divorce is the unpardonable sin. I'm simply saying that if we approach marriage with the idea that it's an open-ended contract, a civil arrangement, then we are looking at it wrong, and it's going to lead to, and it's going to damage our ability to deal with our marriages. I want to come back to this in a minute. Marriage is covenant. But my point is, one of the things we're going to see, this is an overriding principle, one of the things we're going to see is that we're going to have to think very hard about this right to personal happiness. It raises the question of transcendent values, the question of transcendent responsibilities. Man lives with a woman for 30 years, and she is faithful to him. She raises his children, helps him raise his children, and she keeps his home, and she acts with honor. And and some cute little thing comes into his vision. And he all of a sudden decides that he's tired of his wife. And I'm not making this up, by the way. This happens every day. It'll happen today in this town. And he says, wow. And I'm getting to the age when if I'm going to have any last fling, I better fling now while I got something to fling. And what about his responsibilities? Responsibilities to that woman who's lived with for 30 years as a person, apart from considerations of romantic love, what about as a person? Responsibilities. And we're going to come back to this when we come to the hierarchy I'm just introducing these issues here. Are we willing to live with marriage at the mercy of whim and impulse? Many marriages are at the mercy of whim and impulse. I see couples stayed married. We had a couple in our church stayed married for less than 6 months. They got married, you know, on a whim and got divorced on a whim, apparently. But is that what we want? The undergirding philosophy of marriage, recognized or unrecognized, articulated or unarticulated, has a direct impact upon one's regard for and conduct within the marriage relationship. That is, what our view of marriage philosophically has a direct impact upon our practical conduct within the marriage. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Margaret Mead, who's this leading exponent of moral freedom, as you remember, we studied this, those of you in anthropology under me, recall that Margaret Mead, she's the one who wrote this book, Coming of Age in Samoa. So back in the 40s or 30s, I think she wrote it. And what the book, she supposedly found out enough about the Samoan culture to discover that this, that they were the happy, they were a happy, carefree people, absolutely not guilt-ridden, and they practiced free sex. And when she wrote this up, that is, they were free from mental illness, you know, almost comparatively free from mental illness and suicide. And she decided that it was because they practiced free sex. And she wrote this up, and she was immediately, this made her reputation, made her career. She was lionized. She became one of America's honored anthropologists. She's dead now, died a few years ago. And everybody was glad to get that book because it was a declaration of sexual freedom, and it seemed to be, she seemed to make it scientific. Kind of like what Darwin seemed to do for evolution. Well, a few years ago, a scholar went back and restudied her work and re-examined the sources and found out that that the whole thing was meaningless, that she had been fooled. She went to Samoa, she lived with a English-speaking family. She had to work through an interpreter, didn't bother to learn the language, had to work through an interpreter, and she interviewed a bunch of silly girls, young teenage women, teenage girls, who told her what they thought she wanted to hear. As a matter of fact, that number one, the Samoans did not practice sexual freedom. Number two, they had all kinds of guilt, just like everybody else, and suicides, and understand that the whole fabric of her theory was false. One of the things that the researcher showed was that all she had to do was read the newspapers of the day. Go back and look at the newspapers and see how many rapes there were and murders and suicides. Well, and so her work has been discredited. It's interesting, after a whole generation, starting with Coming of Age in Samoa, that book, declared her sexual freedom, and the thing was a fraud. Not that she tried to defraud it. It's that she went ill prepared to do the research, did not do good research, wrote up a study that was 99% imagination, somebody's imagination, probably hers and probably the people she worked with. But because, here's my point, because the world was so, the academic world, the liberal academic world was so anxious to hear something like that they immediately believed it without checking on it, and swooped it up and embraced it and absorbed it and digested it, and there wasn't anything to it. But she said this, and what I'm saying, so this is a very important statement because it comes from the radical left in this question. Quote, the most serious thing, Margaret Mead says, happening in the United States is that people enter marriage with the idea that it is terminable. That's my point. Remember, what I'm trying to say is your view, philosophic or theoretical view of marriage determines how you live marriage at the practical level. And what she's saying is that the most important thing that's happening in this area is that people are getting married with the idea that it's terminal. If it doesn't work out, I haven't lost that much, I'll try somebody else. Cultural or ethnic groups vary widely in the incidence of divorce. Where marriage is by free choice, as it is in our culture, as opposed to marriage being a family arrangement, the sexes are of equal status, divorce is frequent. And we look at our own Western society to see that. Why? Well, because it depends on your view of marriage, your philosophy of marriage, as it were. And I simply mention here, in an introductory way, the impact of philosophy on the matter of preparation for marriage. Okay. Any questions so far? Well, now we can, first of all, we look at the biblical statement, marriage, a divine institution. Now we're going to come back to some of the biblical teachings later. We just introduce them here. Genesis 2, 18 through 24, we have the first marriage. Then the Lord God said, it is not good for man to be alone. One of the things we're going to come back to is the fact that the Bible does not teach that God created marriage for the sake of procreation, for having children. That is not the primary purpose. It doesn't say that. Why did God create marriage? Because God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. He's certainly right about that, wasn't he? Now here we see, if you want to get theological about this, we see man, I think we see, man in the image of God. Why did God create man knowing all the trouble that man was going to cause him? Possibly, it's because that just as it's not good for man who is in the image of God to be alone, it is not good for God himself to be alone. I don't know if that's true, but he wanted us for some reason, wanted us awful bad, doesn't he? Cost him the grief of history and the tragedy of the cross, just so he could bring many sons to glory, to have a family. It's not good to be alone. You go on and read the account how that God found no suitable helper for Adam. Verse 21, so the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place, and the Lord God fashioned into a woman, the rib he had taken from the man, and brought her to the man and said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now that's the first marriage. The first marriage. Matthew 19, 1 through 8, we have the very critical teaching of Jesus, very crucial teaching of Jesus, in the context of the question raised concerning divorce. Matthew 19, 1 through 8. And Jesus quotes this text. It says, the Pharisees come to him, and they say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? And he cites the text which we just read. Verse 6, consequently, they are no longer, Jesus says, two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Well, they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate and divorce her? He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And then he goes on to give the advanced teaching on divorce, only permitted, as I understand, in the case of adultery, not required, but permitted. Now, so this brings us back to what I mentioned earlier, marriage as covenant. Marriage as covenant. Does this affect us at the practical level? Is your marriage, when you form a marriage, what does it mean, marriage as covenant?
What are some practical implications of that? Those of you who aren't married, but plan to be married, maybe you don't have a wedding date set, but it's in your, you don't think of yourself as living single all of your life, or maybe you have a mate picked out. What does it mean to you that marriage is a covenant?
Contract between you and another person to meet each other's needs.
Okay. Anything behind that?
Well, I wouldn't use the word unconditional, but everybody doesn't like that. But something that is not broken, something that...
If you can't break it, if only death or adultery can break it, which shows you what God thinks of adultery, the same level as death. What does that mean to you if you're not married yet? Well, it means, for one thing, don't marry a nitwit, because it's very hard to live all your life with a nitwit. Now, is that practical? I mean, if your mate has room for rent between the ears and that and nothing else, you're in for a long, hard life. Marry somebody. Point is, listen, let me teach you a principle here. We'll come back to this later. I don't want to stray too far. And what happens when you're young is that a person you're in love with can be very delightful and attractive, can be very desirable in all kinds of ways at a certain level, at a certain age. But it takes, my wife taught me this. She said that, especially, by the way, with Bible college girls who are agreeing to marry husbands, that you have to see what a man is going to be. And you have to look at the girl and say, well, here's what she is now. But what's she going to be? What is she becoming? Is there substance there in this mate, man or woman? Or understand? Is there substance there? What are they going to be? What are they? Because marriage is for life. That's our approach. I often say my wife and I have never ever considered divorce. We have talked about murder a couple of times. Have never considered divorce. Now, I don't mean to be indelicate about this, but this is too important to talk around. Ladies, gentlemen, if this person you're in love with is an airhead or has no real convictions, has no substance there, to repeat myself, it's easier to live with that now than it's going to be 20 years from now. You can get by now. Why? Well, there's a lot of physical attraction, there's a lot of busyness, there's a lot of activity. We're in a world of young people. But I'll tell you, we need to pick a mate for the long run. And hear me, the fact that you love them is not a sufficient reason for getting married. Love is not, you see, one of the things, we're going to come to this later, we're going to talk about this modern Western arrangement of falling in love and then getting married, love being the cause, marriage the effect. We've got that. For most of the history of the world, we're going to see when we get into this first section. For most of the history of the world, in most places, for most of human history, the reverse arrangement has been used. You get married, and then because you're married, you fall in love. And one of the things we're going to talk about is the art of falling in love after the marriage, after the wedding. But hear me, dating is fun, weddings are exciting, Ah, but the marriage. The marriage. Now, and but see, my point is that we start with the concept, with the belief, with the view that marriage is covenant. And hear me, when the absence of romantic love does not destroy the covenant. It may make the marriage unhappy, but it does not destroy the covenant. Well, I don't love her anymore. I don't love him anymore. What's that got to do with it? Does that destroy the covenant? No, it does not. What's love got to do with it? Well, it has much to do with it, but what I'm saying, it's not the ultimate and deciding value. I'll just put it this way. I love my wife for all kinds of reasons. And by the way, some of you, I'll talk to you, if you young ladies kind of get together, if you'd like, when we get to the practical section, for Linda to come in and have at least one session where you can get her point of view. I'm sure I can tie her hands behind her and drag her in. She doesn't like to do it, but she's very good at it. But because you're getting a man's point of view on a lot of these things. But if I told you why I love my wife, I could have you all crying. We'd be all snotting and blowing around in here, you know, and you know, dramatic and sentimental. But one of the reasons I love my wife is, I'm very serious now, I'm deadly serious about it. One of the reasons I love my wife is I don't have any choice. I'm stuck with her. I mean, love her or not, she's mine. We both said, till death do us part. We're both very much alive. Not quite as alive as we used to be, but we're alive. And it's very bad being married to somebody you don't love. I can't imagine anything more horrible than going home every night to somebody you didn't love. And since I have to go home to her anyway, I might as well love her. This is very proud. I'm very serious about this. And so I work out ways to love her. Why? Because I'm stuck with her. And she's stuck with me. We got a covenant. And since I understand, since I have her and she's mine and she has me, we just love each other. I'm the only reason. It's a great motive. But where this comes into play is when you come to a crisis in your marriage, what do? You call it off or do you figure out how to fall in love again? That depends on whether you have a covenant or just a contract. Also, any questions on that? No, I'm very serious about that. And some of you have been married for a few years, you know how very important that is. You say, well, if you got to work, it's interesting. It's amazing what you can do if you have to. But even if you can't work it out and fall in love or stay in love, the covenant is still there. You see, now let me teach you something which is going to be hard for you to take. But you see, our culture with its doctrine of the primary right to human happiness, to personal happiness. It has no concept, our culture has no concept of staying with a bad marriage just because you got a covenant. But that's a very recent way of thinking. That is, would a man or a woman stay in a bad situation or an unhappy situation because of a principle? Let me word it this way. Would we sacrifice that much to a principle? Well, you were raised to believe that it's unrealistic to think about sacrificing that much to, you understand, to live with somebody you don't love just because you have a covenant. But the idea that that is unreasonable or unreal, that's one of the modern seculars like the word real, it's not reality. That's a very recent idea. And one of the foundational precepts of Western civilization, one of the things that makes the West different from the East, or that separates civilization from barbarism or paganism, one of the primary principles that created Western civilization is the idea that you sacrifice personal rights for the sake of principle. You sacrifice personal happiness for the sake of principle. And this is just one of them. So while it may seem very unrealistic and unreasonable to us, yet it has not always been so. And I have known people who stayed with bad marriages, who made mistakes. I know a couple. I know there is a couple. I've never learned their name because I don't want to know their name. I went to Bible college with them. And they got married, and they knew from day one that they should not have got married. But the day after the wedding, before their wedding night, they knew that it was a mistake. And they're still married. And they've made the best of it. Now, so that sounds very cruel to us, doesn't it? Very unreasonable, to repeat myself, but it isn't. You see, the same mentality that says, well, if it's a mistake, it's better to call it off and admit your mistake and start again. Even if God does not recognize that. That's the same mentality that says, well, if you make a business contract and you go broke and you can't pay your bills, it's better just to declare bankruptcy and start again. Do you realize what that see, when contracts or covenants start breaking down, then Western civilization starts breaking down because there's nothing to hold it together, and so. Modern divorce is not an isolated phenomenon. It's a part of a pattern. You see, all kinds of human arrangements, covenants, or contracts are being written off, being abandoned for the sake of happiness. You know? If you don't believe that, you go to work for a financial institution sometime. I mean, a person will sign an agreement to pay a debt, and if it gets difficult, forget the agreement. Let the creditor take his chances. One of the things I've always respected about my dad had a business. At least he and another man went into business about 1950, the business went bankrupt. It was not his fault, because it was the kind of business that all the country they went bankrupt. I won't tell you what it was, but they went bankrupt. You know, even thousands of that kind of business went bankrupt. It was bad timing. But anyway, he had a partner, and they were bankrupt. So his partner said, well, let's declare bankruptcy and get out of it, which they legally could have done. But rather than do that, my father bought out his partner and spent 13 years paying off that debt. Now, long after the business was gone, he still paid for it. That's a long time. Rather than not pay back his creditors. And they got every dime. Now that sounds very strange, doesn't it, to modern ears? But my dad's a man of principle. You understand? He gave his word, he went in, he signed his name, he agreed to pay that back. To him, that was a sacred covenant. I learned something from that. The modern man says, well, you know, then declare bankruptcy. Why? To spend 13 years paying off a debt that you legally don't have to pay. If you declare bankruptcy, who pays for it? See, the creditors lose on it. He wouldn't do that. And so it is with marriage. Now, that sounds very grim. Let me say this now, and we'll come back to this later too, because we're in the introductory pages. Now listen to me in, students. The grand paradox of this is that real joy is found in covenant keeping, not covenant breaking. A lot of couples, they stop just short of the joy. I've seen couples get divorced who I'm pretty sure could have had a pretty good marriage if they had just tried it longer. But they went into it with the idea that if it gets too tough, we're quitting. And you realize a lot of good marriages were not good marriages in the first 5 or 10 years. They became good marriages Why? Because often you get a couple, especially this is true when you get married young. Now, you all are marrying later than my generation did. But I think it's good. But you get a couple, just kids, 19, 20 years old, get married. Sometimes it takes 4 or 5 years just learn how to start living together and being together. And if you go into it with the idea that if real trouble, you know, if it gets too much of a bother, we'll quit. You quit too soon. It's like digging for a treasure, and you stop 1 foot before the treasure. You stop digging. You just kept digging. The longer you'd have found it, to use a metaphor. You see what I'm saying? So that covenant, the path of the covenant is the path to joy. There's joy in covenant keeping. Now, there may not be a lot of immediate personal happiness. What I'm saying is that God has made us in such a way that down deep where the real joy is, not the surface giggles, any fool can be happy when everything's going right. You know, it does not take a spiritual quality to giggle. If you don't believe that, just go to a mental institution. Acres. But real joy is down deep, as it was with Jesus. The Bible says that Jesus, for the joy, endured the cross. And that's where the joy very often is, on the other side of the cross. And sometimes that cross is the covenant. And the joy is in covenant keeping. Well, marriage is a divine institution. Any questions on or comments on marriage as covenant?
Yes.
Yes, it's fine.
America is isn't that right?
Yes.
Like
close to 50.
Or something like that. Does that indicate that America is decentralizing or
disintegrating?
Disintegrating.
Yes, culturally it is.
And has it plateaued and on a downswing, or is it continuing to increase?
Divorce is about leveled off, the rate, simply because there are fewer marriages. Fewer marriages because of the demographics. There are few people of the age, percentage-wise, who are coming to that age. You know, this goes up and down. And because a lot of people are living together and not getting divorced. Pretty hard to have a divorce statistic if people never got married.
Well, let's say the future of America.
Wouldn't say much. Now, it doesn't mean that everything's hopeless, but it does mean that that there needs to be a revival, there needs to be a change in this, because, well, we're going to talk later about marriage as the fundamental social unit, foundational social unit. We'll come back to that later. But the in some states, marriage is over 50%. That is over half in any given year, half as many divorces as marriages. And California is higher, I think, and most places lower. It's interesting, the state that every year for the past 20 or 30 years, for every year except three, the state that's had the highest divorce rate is Utah, which is over 70% Mormon. Interesting. Part of the Mormon myth, parenthetically. You know, married Mormons are the good, that's the church for good family life, which is an absolute lie.
Well, they don't say even without amendment. I'm not trying to get into cults. They teach, at least under the table, divorce in order to keep a family member within the church. In other words, get rid of the mate who doesn't want to be a member.
But they teach divorce not just for that, but they teach divorce for if you have a, since they're going to have your wife for eternity, you'll be your wife, you'll be your new, your Eve on your planet, then you better get one you want. So they divorce within their own, within the faithful. Yes?
Do you agree with Grunman then, though, on statistics, when you look at statistics, you gotta be careful. Because he used California's example in the book that not all divorces in California, because a lot of them really never actually married in that state. If you look at one state.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I say in some states, but you have to look, if you have to just, you have to look at overall. But it's also affected by the fact that there are a lot of people just aren't getting married. Well, did you want to pursue that? Yeah.
I'm sure we'll touch on that.
Yes. Well, this the next consideration, any other questions? Yes.
Has there ever been any kind of a
Well, the question is, has this kind of thing been documented? The problem with that is that this is a long-term thing, and that statistics have not been kept until very recent times. So, but all you can get is educated guesses. And if you look at things like the Roman Empire, historians generally agree that was one of the things that contributed to the fall of Rome, which stood for several centuries, was the breakdown of marriage. And that's sort of generally recognized, you understand? But statistic keeping is, it's called quantification. Quantification is a fairly recent thing, which has really just got exploded with the advent of the computer. Not that statistics haven't been kept for very long in human history. I don't think anybody denies that, though. Even the most radical people would admit that that's a problem, that it's a disintegrating influence. For instance, let me give you an example. I'm not a psychologist, but from what little I've read of psychology, the experts are saying, if I understand them, that that children whose parents are divorced, very often, to protect themselves, will get into the habit of insensitivity and detachment. They tend to not become emotionally involved with other people because they've been hurt so bad. And we're getting a generation of people who don't know how to get emotionally involved, don't know how to really care about people. As we're raising up a generation of people, many of whom cannot be people. They relate to things, to machines, but not to people, because they don't want to get emotionally involved. And children who go through a divorce often are likely, maybe some of you have had that problem, I don't know, where you find it very hard to get close and to open up to people and to really form close friendships. Well, that's death. See, that's death to a marriage. Somebody wants to, you know, be stamped, keep the other, everybody at arm's length. You can't get married and do that. That's an example. You see, this it creates after its own kind. Well, we come to marriage. Any other questions? Well, continuing to think about marriage as a divine institution, we move on from marriage as covenant to marriage as trio. Now, this has implications for the spiritual life of the family. Do we view a marriage as a duet or a trio? Well, I teach that marriage is a trio. What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That is, it is not simply a man and a woman forming a team, a marriage. It is a man and a woman and God. Marriage is a trio. God must be considered. Must be the... How many word this way? If marriage is what the Bible says it is, then logic as well as scripture demand that... Logic demands that God be a dynamic element in the marriage. A natural dynamic element. And we're going to come back to that later too. And last of all, marriage as an aspect of faith. You see, we live by faith. When we talk about the Christian faith, and the temptation is, for all kinds of reasons, some of which I'm sure I don't understand, but the temptation, nevertheless, is to somehow view our marriage as something that's something to the side, something secondary. But you see, marriage is an aspect of faith. For example, here's what I mean. I have, when I was in the local ministry, I would not marry a Christian to a non-Christian. I would not marry two non-Christians, simply because I didn't see myself called to be a civil officer. If they want that, they can go to a justice of the peace or to the preacher up the street. You can marry anybody. As long as they could, you know, could walk in or be pushed in a wheelchair and had $10. And one of the reasons I would not marry a Christian to a non-Christian is it's absolutely inconceivable as the Bible teaches, for a Christian to marry a non-Christian, because marriage is an aspect of faith. And if we are of the Christian faith, that means that Jesus is Lord, doesn't it? And how can Jesus be Lord of our life and we become one flesh with somebody who's not even a Christian? It's just inconceivable. It's absurd. It's nonsense, as well as being blasphemous and sinful. Marriage is an aspect of faith. And that's why Paul teaches that we're not to be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, talking about marriage, but much more than marriage. He said the widows must remarry if they're young enough and want to, but only in the Lord. Only in the Lord. Why? Well, it's ridiculous to do otherwise. Now, you have Christians married to non-Christians, this situation reflected in the Corinthian letters, for example, but that was not a matter of a Christian marrying a non-Christian. That was a matter of neither being Christians. One was converted and one was not. Now, we're going to come back to this also, but we simply approach marriage as an aspect of faith. And if a couple does not share a common faith, then pray tell, what do they share besides their bed and maybe what's in the refrigerator? How can a person be a Christian and be married to somebody and consciously, purposely marry somebody with whom you cannot have a common faith? It's just totally out of whack. Now, people try it, but usually the non-Christian, by the way, wins out. The Christian stops being a Christian. That's the statistics. Now, that's the basic principle. Any questions? Now we get to the boring part. And we're gonna work our way through this. I'll do my part, you do yours. There'll be some things in it. By boring, I mean it's data. It's not everyday life. Not most of it, but it's necessary. Okay, come to page 2, the family. Anthropological perspective. Looking at it not from a biblical point of view necessarily, but simply from the viewpoint of anthropology. We're not talking here about what man should do, we're talking about what man has done, whether he should do it or not. The family as a social institution, I'm reading now, has been a universal feature of all human societies. It's interesting. Men have, regardless of how, what we call primitive, and that's a misleading term, but they call simple, non-technological family. No matter where you find people living, under what conditions, or what level of technology or education, they always have families. It has met fundamental human needs. And I list here, this is from an anthropological perspective, the basic human needs met by the family. Number one, companionship. Very simple. It's not good to be alone. Simple companionship. If you're going to marry somebody, make sure they're a good companion. I don't mean to be indelicate about this, but if you're dating and the only time you and your sweetheart get along is when you're making out, you're in real trouble. You better not think about marriage. Companionship. Second, mutual protection. We might call this security, mutual protection. Now, that means in some primitive societies that took a different form than it does in some, but just protection. What protection? All the financial protection, physical protection, and not simply for women. We're not talking about males protecting females, although that often is the case. But simply, the family has served this: that we need to hang together, need to be together. Safety in numbers. And you get a, let me give you an example of mutual protection, where it's not something dramatic or even physical. That isn't, I'm talking about war or anything like that. A family is a very convenient thing. It's a very handy arrangement. For instance, you get two people who can live on one paycheck. Somebody said, well, two people can live as cheaply as one. Yes, only half as long. Well, often it is it's an efficient arrangement financially. It's nice to have, for instance, if you got a lot, one advantage of a large family, it's interesting, I speak from the perspective of large families, but I'm one of six children, all living. My wife is one of six children, and five of whom are living. And as you know, my wife and I have four children. Four children, when we had them, didn't seem like a very big family at all. When I look at other families with four children, it looks like all the children in the world. I said, in fact, we got a couple in the church that have three, and they're going to have another one. And I found myself doing this, and they're good parents. I said, they're not going to have another. That's going to make four children. What are they going to do with four children? That's going to be a lot of children, mine. And I was right in the middle of commiserating with their, and I just, it suddenly dawned on me that I had four children. I said, oh yeah, it didn't seem like that, it didn't seem that bad at all. But it's nice to have large families. For instance, when one of them is out of work, they've got a place to go. It's, you know, it's simple protection, financial protection. You got somebody you can fall back on. Somebody who'll say, hey, you come live. Aren't some of you, like when you get out of college, you're going to have to live with your parents for a while until you, you know, to get your school bill paid, or you know, get yourself squared away? That's protection. That's, you know, that's good. It's mutual protection. Leslie's going to move back in for a while. That's mutual. You see, aren't you glad that you got a? Aren't you glad you're not by yourself? Maybe some of you are by yourself. I feel sorry for people by themselves. And my kids know that if things get worse, things out in the world, they're in the situations, they can go get Dad. He can take care of things, probably. Just simple protection of all kinds. Well, men have always, our families have always, mankind has always done this. Third, division of responsibilities. You know, she has the babies and he brings home the bacon. Right. Well, one of the things we're going to talk about here is the fact that there is no set division of responsibilities. Some women do certain things, other women don't do. But although the division of responsibilities is not always the same division, yet there is in every good home the division of responsibilities. It's simply it's a workable human arrangement, apart from any divine mandates or considerations. For instance, my wife is glad that she can get in the car and drive it, not have to worry about paying the insurance, and half the time not worry about filling the tank. She has a credit. I give her a credit card, and she fills the tank. But she's glad. She doesn't have to worry about the fan belt and the battery and whether the car's been serviced, whether there's air in the tires. She doesn't worry about that. She walks out the front of that house, other than gas being in it. When she gets in and turns the key, she wants that thing to go wherever she wants to go. And when it stops going, she just says, Roger, the car stopped. And she's done. Understand? She's done. And she, now listen to me. Not every woman is like that, but she wants to be done with that. And she is done with it. Why? That's my responsibility. She doesn't want to have to come the first of every month and wonder, is somebody going to put a moving van up to the house and move us out because the mortgage isn't paid? She never thinks about the mortgage, never worries about why. She does. That's my responsibility. Now, but in some families, the woman takes that responsibility. And it's nothing to do with femininity or masculinity. It's simply a mutual agreement on division of responsibilities. My wife, we've been married for 26 years, she has yet to touch a lawnmower. Some women like to get out and mow grass, and they do it, and they're glad to do it, they enjoy it. It's not that my wife doesn't like to mow grass, it's that it never occurred to her. Nor shall it ever occur to her to mow grass. Yeah. Yeah, and I've got a very efficient mowing system. I just point to the lawnmower and find one of my boys and go, and except when they're not around, and I do it myself. But you understand, she doesn't want to worry about it. When I go out to buy a car, and again, this is different. When I buy a car, I go out and buy a car when we need a car, and I come home and I say, honey, I bought a car today, and she says, fine, and she doesn't care. No, I don't take her shopping for a car. Why? She would buy a car for all the wrong reasons. She doesn't care. When she walks out in front of the house, she just wants to be a car there to run. You understand? So there are certain things that she has responsibilities that I don't want to worry about. She doesn't want me in her kitchen. And that makes two of us. I mean, I burned the Kool-Aid. Now, some men, I mean, I can fix a bowl of cereal and hit it right most of the time. That's about it. When I've done that, I'm finished. Now, some men are excellent cooks, and they like cooking, and they'll cook a meal for their wives, and I admire them. Like, I kind of envy them. I wish I could. I just never done it. And so when I reach in my sock drawer, I expect clean socks to be there because I don't wash clothes unless you come. But you see, some men do. You see what I'm, but there's a, but the division is not always the same division, and we must not fall into this macho trap of saying, well, that's always woman's work and that's always man's work. But there is this very handy division of responsibilities, and it works. And God help the person who's married to a selfish, spoiled brat, be it a man or a woman, whose mommy always took care of them, who will not take their responsibility when you pick up their clothes. It's a very bad situation. There has to be a division of responsibility. And as children come along, it makes life work easier. I take care of certain things for her. She takes care of certain things for me. We have free time. It works. And this is simply... This is very proud, and man has always found this. Now, let me just say one thing. It sounds like like the traditional male-female role. I want you to know that I don't know of any woman who's any better at changing a diaper than I am. But I haven't done it for a long time. But you know, I didn't believe in this stuff of when you're home playing with the kids, you know, you're off on Saturday and the kid, baby, needs a diaper change. You don't say, honey, come and do your job. You know, I knew where the diaper pail was, and I used to, you know, I could whip that thing out. I had a technique down. I had no little, you know, I forget how I did it, but it's been so long. You see, and because it was, it's time, I recall, about whenever I think of division of responsibility, one of my favorite memories is, for years, I never took a bath alone. I'd be in the bathtub, and my wife would say, hey, you want some company? She didn't mean her. not always. you'd say, why, kids need a bath, you know, the little toddlers, maybe, boys, you know. And I'd be sitting there. I used to like to read in the bathtub. I don't do anymore for some reason, but I'd like to, you know, run a hot tub of water and get a good book and read. And pretty soon, she'd come by and she'd just start dropping kids in. And worked out very well, you know, and I'd scrub them up and you know, say, they're ready, you know, I'd set them out and she'd put them down. And listen, we could go through three or four kids just in a couple, 3 minutes. I mean, you talk about Saturday night bath night, very efficient. She'd dump them in, I'd clean them up, hand them out, and they'd be ready for bed. Division of responsibilities. The next is very simple, very straightforward, not particularly complicated, the care of dependent offspring. It's a very efficient way for caring for children, family. It's the best, by the way, it's the best arrangement we know. Daycare is not the best arrangement. Mommy and daddy is the best arrangement. Now, daycare is sometimes necessary. Sometimes it isn't. We're going to talk about that when it comes to part two. But, for instance, what better arrangement to raise children, take care of them, provide them, get their measles shots, get them an education, Very good arrangement. Fifth, the instruction of dependent offspring. How is one generation going to learn how to be a part of a culture? The best place is the home to learn. And by the way, this is one of the signs of a disintegrating culture. When the home doesn't do its job, it's impossible for the rest of society. In instruction, it's impossible for the rest of society to make up for it. See, one of the problems we've got in America is that Americans, because of our public school system, we've gotten in the idea that, well, that education is the school's responsibility. It is, but not the primary responsibility. But religious instruction, that's the church's responsibility. The problem is that when it comes to the basic teachings, moral teachings and attitudes, things like that, it has to come from the home. If it doesn't happen in the home, it doesn't happen at all. You understand? If the home doesn't, what I'm saying is this, if the home, we're going to study, if the home doesn't do its job, then the church and the public school system cannot make up for it. And do not make up for it. And last of all, if the family furnishes the fundamental building block of social institutions. Well, Jeff, this is the university recognized. And if that building block isn't there, then society disintegrates. Okay, any questions on that? Well, again, looking at it anthropologically, family patterns, monogamy, meaning, this is Greek, gamos is the word for mate or marriage, mono means one mate. Monogamy is the almost universal arrangement. Regardless of what moral or religious teaching there is, monogamy is that which is almost always found, sort of the natural arrangement. One man, one woman. And monogamy means one man, one woman, not two men or two women. So as we point out, when God created the world, he created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Right? Yeah, right. I recall Ogden Nash, one of my favorite poets. You know about Ogden, he's dead now. Ogden Nash, when he talked about an upcoming marriage, said they're about to commit monogamy. Well, most people commit monogamy. It is the almost universal arrangement, suggesting it's the most natural, reflecting the nature of man as created by God. It's the most efficient, and it's the ideal. It's implicit in the Edenic arrangement. By that I mean, it's implicit in the fact that in the original marriage, God created one man and one woman and brought them together, creating one marriage. Monogamy. Now, that is the almost, underline the word almost universal arrangement. There are exceptions, which we're going to look at now. The one exception is polyandry, again Greek, polus, many, andros, andros is the genitive, man, one, as many men, more than one man. Polyandry is a situation where you have a woman who has more than one husband. This is a minority and exceptional arrangement. You almost never find it. I list some of the groups in which it has been found. Note this, it's not always found. It has been found among Eskimos, the Palawan Philippine Pygmies, the Shoshoneans of the Western United States, Tibetans, the Totas of Southern India, and a few others. Those aren't exactly mainstream people. But look at this next statement. Even in societies where polyandry is accepted or admitted, the majority of persons live monogamously. You got that? When we say polyandry has been found among these peoples, we are not saying that it is the normal arrangement. It has been accepted and admitted, but even in polyandrous societies, most people live monogamously.
That is, it is exceptional even in those societies. And often, to qualify it further, often genuine polyandry is not practiced even in these groups in the sense of long-standing domestic unions. That is, even those who, even when these in the exceptions, polyandry has been practiced, it has not been practiced as a parallel to monogamy. It's usually been a temporary arrangement because of an emergency situation, or a temporary arrangement wherein one woman was shared by more than one man. So you understand, so you don't find genuine polyandry anywhere in the sense that of being marriage in the monogamous sense and parallel to it. It's almost isn't that. The next exception is polygyny or polygamy. I give you both terms because both are correct. Gune is the Greek word for woman. It means more than one wife. You got that? So you'll find both terms, polygamy or polygyny. It's seldom now. You find polygamy a little more often than you find polyandry. Well, our time is up, and we'll, I think we'll, before we get into the discussion of polygamy, we'll stop there.